What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This morning, I'm joined by Deputy Editor Nathan Ingram. Hey, Nate.
Good morning, Devendra.
Good morning. We've also got Podcast Producer Ben Ellman here. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. It is, I don't know, T-minus 5 days before iPhone Day, before September 9th as we're recording this. We're recording this on September 4th. We've already done our iPhone rumor roundup last week with Mr. Mark Gurman from Bloomberg, so go check out that. But this week, I think we're going to talk about the vibes, about how we're feeling about this launch, because I've noticed nobody really cares. Like, this is a very muted Apple launch, even for the dull years. Like, I think even last year I felt a little more hype, even though this year you're going to actually get a new iPhone with a whole new design. I don't know. Maybe I'm just out of tune, but we'll talk about how we're feeling about the new phone, where Apple's headed. We've also got some news to dive into, including a major update on US v. Google. Turns out Google will not be facing many consequences for being a search monopoly. What fun. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And also, we'll take your questions for our Ask Engadget section there. So, you know, drop us anything, AMA, ask us anything, things you want us to solve or just things you want us to ponder on the show. And also join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel for our live stream. You'll get to see our faces. Sometimes we'll show off gadgets and we'll do some Q&A with the audience. So join us for that. All right. Nate, iPhone 17. Like, let's lay down the things we're expecting next week. It's iPhone 17, you know, basic and pro. iPhone 17 Air, which is the super slim 5.5 millimeter thick model we've been that's been rumored for a while now. And that seems like it's pretty much it. Are you excited about any of this hardware?
Not terribly. And I think, and I'm guessing that you and Mark Gurman got into this last week a bit, that, you know, he published that article recently where it was like the 3-year kind of plan, right? And I think you could say that we're at the end of one iPhone era right now, right? Like, next year we're expecting new stuff, more transformative stuff. This is the like last year of getting the like nips and tucks and tweaking of things to optimize the old design, which has kind of been around since 2020. So yeah, it's hard to get super excited about that. I personally need a new phone, so I'm like looking forward to having a new option. And I kind of like the idea of having the like super optimized version of what they've been putting out, because I think it's still pretty good. But yeah, it's hard to get excited about it, right? There's not that much to talk about. Even though for the first time in a few years, they are releasing a totally new model.
That's right, yeah, that doesn't happen very often. We've not seen a brand new looking iPhone design since the iPhone 10, really.
Like, yeah, probably that was the last time they made a really big change. And like the 10 and the 11 were kind of like iterations on, or like the 10s and the 11 were iterations, and then with the 12 they went to the flat sides. And since then, it's been kind of like they got the regular, the Pro has 3 cameras, the regular has 2. Like, that's all been
the same. We lost the notch. We lost the notch somewhere in there, too, with the, what is that thing called? Is it the Magic Island? I don't know.
The Dynamic Island.
Yeah. Which I do actually like. I think that's a
useful thing. Yeah, I do, too. If you're going to have a spot, which I understand why physics dictates that they need that, like, it's a pretty good use of it.
Yep.
But yeah, the Air is interesting because I don't think anyone's really asking for a thinner iPhone with worse battery and fewer cameras.
well, it's so I think you're right. I think that's
so
the main thing.
Why? Yeah. You know, I saw some study, and I don't know how you know, rigorous it was, but it was like the things people want is like more battery, bigger screen, etc. And I think the most interesting thing about this is that they're getting rid of the standard iPhone Plus, right? So they're only going to have one iPhone 17 with the presumably the 6.1-ish inch screen. They're not going to have a second big one. Mm-hmm. So if you want
rumor is the screen is going to be slightly bigger than last year.
Like, okay, yeah. If you want like a substantial screen increase, you've got to jump all the way to the like whatever 18 Pro Max, which will probably cost $1,200 starting. And that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, it's $300-$400 more than I think the iPhone like 17 Plus was, or 16 Plus.
16, yeah. It is a weird situation that we're stepping into, because we're not really expecting a huge change for the basic iPhone 17, slightly bigger screen, but not so much. They may have the promotion screen. That is something we've seen. So high refresh rate there, essentially getting a lot of what was in the iPhone 16 Pro. It's kind of that downsample to the base model. I don't think anybody's really going to miss the Plus. I have liked the Plus for my mom, who has trouble seeing things on small screens. So that is a bigger screen that's easier for her to use. So I recently bought her like a 13 Plus use that turned out to be pretty good for her. But it kind of seems like, to your point, Nate, I don't think anybody is asking for a super thin phone. But it does seem like these companies, when they've reached like an innovation point, it's more like, look what I can do. Look at what I can make, which is an iPhone that is crazy thin. And Samsung has already done this with one of the recent Galaxies that is meant to be super thin. And honestly, Apple has done this too with the iPad Pro. But in that one, they sold both. It became the new Pro, right? It replaced the old model. It was still faster. It still had better battery life. It was still functionally a better iPad Pro. It was just super thin. It seems like this time they're trying to sell a functionally slightly worse iPhone with less camera and potentially less battery life, according to Gurman. They're trying to sell that, and the main selling point is just thin, just design. Is that, I'm not super compelled by that, especially since practically it's going to be a worse phone. How does that like sit with you, Nate? Do you think the broader public will care for that?
I don't think so, because of everything you just said, and it depends on the price too. But it would be hard, let's say you've got the iPhone 7, the base vanilla 17, right? The base 16 was a really good phone this past year. Like you said, it's been picking up stuff that the pros had. Like it has the dynamic island now. It has the camera button and the action button. And, you know, to your iPad point, you know, I've been using the iPad Pro since it came out. It's been a year and a half already, which is crazy to me. But
the new thin one,
thinner without sacrificing anything.
Yeah,
same. It's got like a M4. It's got you know, amazing, unbelievable screen. Battery life is still good, so you're not giving anything up. And with a tablet that you hold, making it thinner and thus lighter goes a long way towards being able to like hand hold like the 13 inch Pro. Like it's light enough that it doesn't feel weird to do that now. Whereas before, it still always felt to me a little bit awkward to hold in your hands.
Yeah.
So there's a benefit there. And then with the Air, I don't know what the benefit is except for like it being super thin. And like in a vacuum, that sounds nice, but I don't want to compromise certainly on the battery or the cameras, to be honest.
It seems like Apple's going to serve like everybody, right? The base iPhone's going to be there for the typical customer who does not need the stuff in the Pro phone, but will still have decent battery life. The Air will be the design-focused one. The Pro models are still around, and I think in many ways the Pro upgrades will be useful for the people who care about things like Pro upgrades. Some of the things I've read, including up to 8x zoom on the Pro Max, 48 megapixel rear cameras across all the Pros. Let me see here.
That's intriguing to me.
That's intriguing. Because they're rearranging the camera array, so it's going to be fully across the top, sort of like the Pixel phones, they may only use glass on the bottom part and not all the way to the edges. So like glass just in the middle, maybe to help with reception, but that potentially makes it more durable.
The glass usually for wireless.
Yeah. You need the charging, a vapor chamber cooling system, which could help it run, you know, cooler and more efficiently to metal covered battery. Just seems like the hardcore Pro phone. This seems like, you know, the Pro phones for people who really care about this stuff and who live on their iPhones a lot. This is why I've been on the Pros since they've come out. The one thing that is kind of disappointing to me, I'm hearing potentially return to the all aluminum frame instead of the sort of...
Yeah, surprising.
Yeah, instead of the mix between titanium and aluminum that we saw last year, that is one, or 2 years ago. That's one reason I jumped up to I have the 15 Pro Max, and it makes the Max phone feel lighter because it is lighter metal. So we may go back to a slightly heavier Pro Max. Unfortunately, they got me because like I like the screen size. I like this battery life. I live on my phone more than I would like an iPad. So even if it's slightly heavier, I'll probably just have to live with it. How do you feel about those changes to the Pros, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, so I have a 14 Pro, so I'm going back a little bit, and mine has the stainless steel, which actually I love from an aesthetics and hand feel perspective. However, I can respect and understand why like going to titanium, you know, makes it lighter. And especially when you're talking about the larger phone like that, you know, I've always appreciated like if I'm shelling out this much cash for a device that it has some premium material to it. So going to aluminum, I think would be like a major bummer, to be quite frank. Like if I'm going to do that, then like part of me is like, well, I might as well just buy the base model. But I'm still miffed that it sounds like the base model will just have the two cameras. Google goes ahead and puts three on the Pixel 10 base model, which I think was like really compelling to me. Like going away from having a telephoto lens would be a real bummer. I don't want to do that at this point. I take tons of pictures and I like having that option.
It's useful.
For an actual optical zoom.
Yeah.
And being able to get that on a Pixel for $800, like that's the kind of thing that makes one think about switching, to be honest.
One upgrade I'm hearing that could affect all the phones is potentially a 24 megapixel front-facing camera up from 12 megapixels that we've seen for the last few years. Now that's interesting because it means better video quality potentially too, but also a lot more selfie potential, I guess you'll call it, mm-hmm. because like you can crop in more, you could probably do more. Hopefully it's going to be just like a higher quality sensor in general. Does that float your boat at all, Nate?
Yeah, I think basically like you said, like having more pixels just gives you more options in that sense. So I wonder if they'll do something along the lines of on the iPad, which has the kind of center stage camera, which I think it's still 12 megapixels, but it's a very naturally wide angle camera that it crops in and lets you move around as needed. And I wonder if they're going to do something in that vein where, you know, the end result will still be a 12 megapixel, but you can go wider if you've got more people, or, you know, crop in if it's just you or you and one other person. So I don't take a lot of selfies, but I know that everyone does. So like, obviously, like, yeah, that's an important thing.
You also have to think about video creators. You know, everybody on TikTok and Instagram Reels, we've become a society of the front-facing camera. That's how people record a lot of their, you know, direct-to-camera, oh, I just had this thought, like sort of TikToks. And it's crazy that we haven't had like a significant update in
it's a gotten long better. Time. It's gotten slowly that's better, a, but yeah.
That's a good shout, though, because I think today, I believe, yeah, Adobe said that they are bringing Premiere to the iPhone. And so when you think about like the pipeline of editing and stuff for people who are, again, yeah, shooting Reels, TikTok, etc., having that software on a phone with a correspondingly better front-facing camera just makes it even easier to do everything right on the one device and get stuff, you know, out to the internet quicker. So, yeah, I can certainly see why that would be a big deal for a lot of people.
I think I'd hate using a like heavy duty video editing app on my phone. It would feel like I don't know, trying to edit on a desktop, but with like my hands cut off or something. But that's just me.
You're not old, but you know the
Oh, you know, I get it. I get it.
You're old like, school.
I don't know if the kids will care.
Well, yeah. No, but yeah, 14-year-olds would definitely do.
Well,
that.
Everyone's using CapCut. Like everyone's using software that is natively made for video editing on mobile, right? So it's like Adobe's trying to get there and like, oh man, how did we let this happen? But iMovie's there. If you have an iPhone, iMovie's been there for a long time. I don't think creators are doing a lot of like hardcore video editing other than
slap it together, get it online, move on to the next thing.
The CapCut is there. CapCut is the thing. I don't think Apple could ever really change the sort of aperture or the sort of lens size of the selfie just because people are so trained on it, right? If you tweak anything there, creators are going to flip out. But yeah, if you give the default kind of framing right now and then give the ability to go a little more wide, which you can do now, but it is...
Yeah, but it's pretty small.
It's pretty small. That could be a useful thing. I think the better cropping is something too. So, you know, anybody who gets one of these new phones will have some sort of new front-facing camera to deal with. Is there anything... So you need to upgrade this year, Nate. I also feel like I need to upgrade this year also. I'm still fine with the 15 Pro Max because that still runs Apple Intelligence. This year's update's not that interesting. Next year, the rumors are most likely the Fold. If you got something this year, would you consider jumping to a Fold next year if it was good enough?
Not if it's going to cost $1,800 or whatever Google and Samsung's do. I just can't.
It will.
I just can't.
It will.
Like, yeah, it will. And I mm-hmm. can't. There's no earthly reason for me to spend.
Do you pay your phone prices, your phone costs all up front, or do you divide up into?
I haven't historically. I'm thinking I might this year just because I like the idea of having it just be done. And my phone will be paid off, so I'll get like a decent trade in for it and I can just, you know, call it a day. But however, you know, that aside, I'm sure I don't think the Folds are going to be mainstream yet, but they have to do it, obviously, at this point. And in typical Apple fashion, they're letting, you know, the Android manufacturers mess around with it. Like Samsung's first couple were just not good, and now they're good. And now Apple's like, okay, this market's mature enough for us to step into. And I'd seen somebody say something along the lines of the Air is going to be like half of the fold.
Basically.
Which like makes a ton of sense to me. Like that's a reason to do it, I suppose, just for like, you know, R&D, right?
You prove you can do it, that you can build this thing. Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing that doesn't make sense to me is you're going to make all of these iPhone Air, which is half of the phone, but the reputation that the iPhone Air is probably going to have is, why did they even make this battery too small? And it's also not small enough to satisfy the people who are already really missing the iPhone Mini. They're doing this whole production process to, I guess, make sure their factories are like up to snuff for like the next step in their plan. But there are going to be a lot of unhappy people who don't follow things like Engadget so closely. And they're like, oh, cool, thin phone. And they're going to be like annoyed within
probably,
4 months.
Probably.
What is the possible like PR hit Apple could
take? I think
we're
just going to like, I think there's going to have to be something that we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
About this device to make it more compelling. And maybe I'm setting myself up for a letdown by saying that, because like I don't know what it could be.
Yeah, it seems like all like, the features, all the rumored features are out there. So it's like I don't know what they could really surprise us with.
Will it have promotion? Will it have always on display? I guess it can't have always on display if the battery is going to be lousy. Mm-hmm. They're going to need to throttle that. I don't know. I just don't see a market for it. And the interesting thing is that it seems like for several years, they've been trying to figure out what that other device is, right? Like there's the base size, there's the Plus or the Max. They had the Mini for a little bit, but the fact that they're getting rid of the Plus tells me there was less of a market for that than they thought. And they got rid of the Mini because there was less of a market for that than they thought.
And people complained about battery life on the Mini. Like that's the main thing too. Yes. So to what you're saying, Ben, like I think people do jump to these like unique versions, but I just saw somebody online saying, oh, my iPhone, I think 13 Mini, I forgot when they stopped, but oh, my Mini, the battery life is terrible. Now, so several years later, I wish Apple made devices that you know weren't just so disposable. And I really had to restrain myself from replying, being like, well, you bought the smaller phone. It's an old phone. In general, you should probably, if you want to keep your phone, it's probably good to do a battery refresh within like 2 to 3 years. That's just physics, unfortunately. Like these batteries wear down over time. They're less useful. They don't last as long. But I get the frustration is totally real because a normal consumer does not see, like, they're not going to go read our Engadget reviews, unfortunately. They say, ooh, new phone, new small phone, I get phone. And yeah,
new thin phone.
Looks nice.
So I will, my thought that I just had is I think Apple is making this phone for the market of people who want to feel something. Like to be like, I know we also make the jokes, oh, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z just to feel something. And I just had the thought of being like, I'm so bored. I've been buying these phones for so long. I was like, maybe I'll just get this weird new one just to feel something. Even if it ends up being anger eventually.
Right? That's me telling myself not to get a folding Android phone just to feel something and play with it essentially. But you know,
like I was saying to somebody, I was like, maybe I should put the iOS 26 beta on my phone just to feel something.
You should do that, Nate. It's been long enough. It's pretty stable now. I did that.
There's something to I kind of like waiting till like launch day for. I don't know why. Like I've had the betas on my iPads for ages because I've been testing it. So you know, but also my phone is old and I don't want to like trash the battery further. So I'm like, maybe I'll just wait till I get the new one.
Nate, speaking of old phones, I want to bring in just one comment from our live stream chat. Reminder, if you're only listening to the RSS version, we do a live stream for the podcast on the Engadget YouTube page. But I want to bring in a comment that's kind of like news you can use sort of thing. So Michael Angel Dominguez asks, can y'all compare the difference between the batteries in the iPhone 14 and the iPhone 17 in terms of hours of use?
Yeah, I mean, I think every year they say, oh, it's X hours longer. And I feel like it's going to feel, when you buy a new phone, it's going to feel longer because it's a brand new battery. So you're not dealing with something that's running at like 90% or 85% capacity like mine is. So there's going to be that immediate like hit of like, ooh, better battery. But I don't know, you know, longevity, like, you know, how it's going to feel in 6 months or a year. Like by then you'll lose some capacity and then it'll feel not quite good enough again. It's like that's what happens to me with everything. Like my Apple Watch is almost 2 years old, and at some point in the last 3 to 6 months, the battery just like crashed on me, and I feel like I can't barely get through a day with it. It's so frustrating.
And battery life is about more than just the size of the battery. It's the efficiency of the chip. It's how much power does the display draw, because that's the thing sucking up most of the power most of the time. How efficient are the modems and the antennas? Like all of that, all when your phone heats up, when you're downloading a big app or something, that's power. That's power being, you know, drained from your system. I'm looking up quickly here. We can compare the iPhone 16 to the 14. The iPhone 16 has a 3,500 milliamp battery. The 14, not listed, but the 14 Pro had a 3,200 milliamp battery, so probably around 3,000, you know.
So I'm looking at the Wikipedia article for the 14 base. 14 base is 3,279 milliamps.
So 3,200-ish. The 16 only has slightly a couple hundred more milliamps, but it has a vastly different processor and a much more efficient one. So that's why it's really hard to measure battery life.
We'll see what the new chip is like, right?
And then we will see.
That is one thing that obviously Apple's been doing well, is the chips in there keep getting better. So, you know, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. I will say the one red flag we heard from Mark Gurman last week was that potentially the iPhone Air's battery will be smaller than the base 17, and potentially just like similar to the size of the iPhone 12 or 13, which is, that's small. That is small, unfortunately.
I will say, so there's one other thing about this upcoming event I think is worth a quick mention on, which actually is perhaps the most exciting thing to me, is the AirPods 3 or AirPods Pro 3, if those come out. I only bring this up because I think you could make an argument that the AirPods Pro 2 has been one of Apple's just best overall products in the last 5 years. You know, I've had mine for, I think, almost since they launched, and they're just great. They work, they sound really good. They've added a lot of interesting new features since they came out. You know, like that is the kind of thing that, like, yes, there's a little sticker shock when you buy it, but then you use it almost every day for 4 or 5 years. And imagining not having them is a bummer. So I'm excited to see what they do with the new
ones. Is such a halo product, because like, I remember I went to go see a movie. It fell out of my pocket, got somewhere in the theater seat, and I did not know until I had left. So I went back the next day being like, hey, has anybody seen these? I was able to like go in with the manager and look, disappeared, because people love these things, unfortunately. And I just bought a new pair. Like, I didn't suck it up. I have a lot of earbuds. I have so many earbuds all around me, but I'm like, the convenience of the Siri access.
I think I washed a pair of mine. Yeah. And then got them again.
Yeah. Like that's a sign that if you cannot live without a product easily, it is a total success. I don't think this can be the case for the iPhone 17 Air, but we will see. We're only a couple days away. We're going to have a lot of coverage there, by the way. Like, we're going to have people on the ground. We're going to be doing a live blog. And if we have time, maybe we'll do a little bit of a live stream right after the event, but we shall see. Nate, thank you so much for joining us. Where can we find you online these days?
Yeah, I am on Blue Sky and Threads occasionally at Nate Ingram. And you can always send me a nasty email at nathan@engadget.com.
All right, let's move on to some other news. I think the biggest story this week, other than waiting to see what the heck Apple's going to do, and the most substantial story of the week, is the culmination of the US v. Google antitrust suit. And it turns out Google does not have to sell Chrome, doesn't have to divest anything. And this is a judgment from Amit Mehta, the same judge who ruled that Google was a search monopoly last year. So I think after looking at everything, let me see here. Here's a quote that we have in our article by Chris Abell. He says, Google will not be required to divest Chrome, nor will the court include a contingent divestiture of the Android operating system in the final judgment. Plaintiffs, that's the government, overreached in seeking forced divestiture of these key assets, which Google did not use to effect any illegal restraints. So, end quote. Essentially, they're saying that the government asked for too much by asking for those breakups, even though that the search, you know, was deemed a monopoly. They're going to be doing some other things. They're going to share some search data, not all search data. Google will not be able to do some exclusive deals. This is where it gets confusing. So let me just break this down. I'm quoting our article.
Yeah, I was confused by this, and I was going to ask you, like, so you don't have to preload apps in order to get access to the Play Store. I didn't even know that the Play Store was walled off.
That was an issue. That's why Amazon Fire devices do not have Play Store apps. They don't have Google apps or the Play Store. They had to build their own store because they don't have those base level Google apps in there. So that's an interesting thing that could change the way Android tablets or Android devices in general work. But the main thing is Google will be able to continue to pay partners like Apple for preloading search and other apps into their products. The judge said that ending these arrangements could cause downstream harms to distribution partners, related markets, and consumers. And that is an interesting one because we did talk about how essentially 90% of Mozilla's revenue, Mozilla's a nonprofit, but the maker of the Firefox browser, 90% came from this Google search deal to make Google the default search engine in Firefox. If that breakup happened and nobody was paying Mozilla, like that company's done. Mozilla would just freaking die. And that is, so I think part of the reasoning was that to avoid unintended outcomes like that, that's one reason why they didn't break up these companies. I don't think that's necessarily a good reason, Ben. Like, I think that is a sign of just how badly Google's like entrenched in everything. And it's unfortunate that a company like Mozilla is just, it's basically just an arm of Google at this point.
Also, Google can still decide at any point that it doesn't want to send all of this money over to Mozilla.
So Google still can pay partners to be preloaded as a search for apps and products and things like that. But this one thing is getting confusing. Like, Google will no longer be permitted to strike exclusive deals around the distribution of search, Google Assistant, Gemini, or Chrome, Meta ruled. And I don't quite know what that means. That is where it's getting kind of, you can't still pay to be the default search engine, but exclusivity deals, like specific exclusivity deals, that's maybe that means to like not let other people potentially be there. I've seen some reporting around this lawsuit or the sort of judgment is that a company could potentially have multiple defaults, right? You could have Google as your default search engine in Safari, but you turn on private browsing mode. Maybe the default there is a private, you know, search engine that doesn't take as much data. Maybe they could do something like that. Yeah.
Although we found out that DuckDuckGo is like sending search data to Microsoft like a long time ago. But when we're talking about like unintended consequences, we also should think about the regulatory climate in the United States right now. And this judge might be trying to work within something that makes sense for regulation, but also isn't going to start some fight between the tech industry and the tech industry, the judicial, and then the executive being really annoyed at the judicial that they're actually doing regulations, you know?
This is a weird story because this thing started in the first Trump administration when they wanted to really take it hard to big tech. Like they were really pushing big tech companies. Then
Now there's a lot more big
now there's
tech
a lot more
people
big tech
in the administration.
But also then in the Biden administration, we had Lina Khan, who we've talked about quite a bit, who did a lot of work towards like making the FTC a much more modern agency when it came to seeing how regulations work. So the thing about search, right, and a lot of these products is that you're not paying anything for it, right? And essentially, before, the way the U.S. government determined, or the way regulatory agencies determined monopolies was, are you hurting the sort of like price? Are consumers paying too much for this product because you've axed out the competition? You can't really do that for free products. So you have to think about it in other ways. And part of Lina Khan's arguments was that, you know, Google is muscling out any other search competition, especially because it's so big, it can just pay to be the default on all these other platforms. There's no way for a new search engine to come in and stay alive. One other thing that's changed, Ben, not just the administrations, but is that generative AI is now a thing and has quickly become like a bit of an Achilles heel for Google, right? Like Google was sitting pretty for a very long time. Then ChatGPT came out, OpenAI came out as this major competitor in the AI world. Google was forced to get its own things out there, and it was like embarrassing how unprepared they were for it. Now they have Gemini, now they can kind of do more, but Google is not seen as the generative AI leader, right? Google is seen as kind of an also-ran because OpenAI has just made these major leaps on the consumer front before Google. I think the court's sort of like saying, well, this is happening. You're actually not the top dog completely anymore. Even if you have the monopoly in search, the future is not search. The future is sort of like this other thing. People are using Gen AI as search.
The future is zero-click search.
Well, zero-click search, and also things telling you how to feel. Like it's generative AI search, and I really don't like using it that way. But anyway.
So let's move from Google in the courts to Google in your house. Tell me more about this Gemini smart home thing, because this gets to what I've been saying for so long, which is generative AI is best when you can talk to your voice assistant.
I mean, we don't know. What we do know is that Google's going to reveal more information about its Gemini for Home plans on October 1st. So there's going to be some sort of virtual event, I guess, where we will get to see the stuff in action. But I'm reading from our article by Steve Dent here. Gemini for Home will replace Google Assistant and enable natural language commands, plus easier to use controls. You could use it to come up with recipes based on ingredients in your fridge, provide information on general topics like buying a car, and help you troubleshoot home appliance issues. It'll be available both in free and subscription versions, like what Amazon is doing with Alexa and Alexa Plus, and will be a function of multiple smart home devices. So it could be like the Google Home smart tablet, could be multiple things, and some of the speakers. When I say be careful about like getting too hyped about anything Google promises, the way I've seen multiple companies be like, oh yeah, I can whip you up a recipe just like that. Just give me some ingredients and I can make you some amazing recipes. That was one thing IBM was selling with Watson over a decade ago. It was like, hey, give Watson a couple ingredients and it's going to make some really unique, cool recipes. And I remember going to some...
Elmer's glue to keep the cheese on the pizza or something.
That was Google. Wasn't that Google? I forget. Well, that was Google, but I'm talking about IBM now. But Watson would do things sort of like, oh, it's combining two different flavors you would never think about, but combining them in a way like an experimental gastropub or something would like try to come up with new recipes. And that was cool, but not very useful. And now it kind of seems like they're doing, guess, the same thing. We don't know. We don't know what this functionality will be, but essentially you'll be able to talk to Gemini for Home the way you do Google Assistant, the way you do Alexa and Siri, and maybe it'll be able to do more stuff in your home. All I can tell you guys is I currently have Google Nest thermostats. I set up my schedule religiously. The stupid thing cannot read a goddamn schedule. It cannot start cooling my house at the time I've allotted. It's one job. I don't trust Google with any of the smart home stuff, especially. We'll see where this goes. I'm not super excited. Do you have any smart home products like you rely on actually, Ben, or is this all theoretical for you?
It's mostly theoretical for me. I have gotten smart home products to plug in, play with, and then unplug, because the idea of having something always listening still scares me. I don't have Hey Siri enabled on my phone. The most like cynical people are like, huh, you think enabling Hey Siri means that it's only listening to you then? Like, that's all I can do.
That's the only power we have, unfortunately. Yeah.
I don't want to opt into more things listening to me than I absolutely need.
Totally fair. Totally fair. Anyway, we will see what happens with that. Some news that dropped this morning, by the way, totally wild. Atlassian, the company that's behind, like, you know, what does Atlassian own? They own like SaaS products. They own things that corporations use and typical consumers don't use. I think Trello is owned by them at this point. They are buying.
Oh, they have Jira.
They have Jira.
Like,
yes.
If you've ever used like product management software or something. Like,
well, anyway, they announced that they're going to be buying the browser company, developers of the Arc browser and the Dia AI browser. We've talked about that a couple of months ago. They're buying them for $610 million. And the quote here is hilarious. From Mike Cannon Brooks, Atlassian CEO and co-founder, he says, "Today's browsers weren't built for work. They were built for browsing." It's in the name. "This deal is a bold step forward in reimagining the browser for knowledge work in the AI era," end quote. "Together, we'll create an AI-powered browser that'll optimize for the many SaaS applications living in tabs, one that knowledge workers will love to use every day," end quote. I don't know what that means. I don't, whenever people talk about SaaS products and stuff like this, this is why I don't write about enterprise tech, because a lot of this stuff is like gobbledygook and it matters mostly to enterprise people who deal with enterprise stuff. So like IT people will care more about this, people who manage like stuff at the high level government or high level company, you know, situations. According to Josh Miller, the browser company CEO, the company will still operate independently under Atlassian and will continue to develop the Dia AI browser. So, you know,
for how long, though?
For how long? Who knows how long this stuff happens? Basically, until it's inconvenient, you know, until like the browser company is taking more time there rather than implementing stuff for Atlassian. That's probably how long. But what a weird end for this company, because we used to talk about the browser companies like, oh, they're making a cool new type of browser. What a different thing. Like, give us some actual competition to Chrome and everything. This is what
I've played around with Arc. It was kind of confusing. Yeah. Like, it was fun that it was a different way of interacting with the browser. And it wasn't just like you have your bar and you have your tabs and everything. Like, the bar only comes up when you need it. It did have a lot more space for the actual web page. But maybe coming back to the idea of smartphones, like maybe we've found like the perfect form for the browser, and anything else is, you know, you use it because you want to feel something.
You want to feel something.
That's the theme of this
episode.
You want
to be a little different. It's all about feels. It's all about vibes, guys. But also in here is like, this is a company that's an upstart that tried to compete with Chrome. And this, again, back to the monopoly. It is so hard to compete with Google's entrenched software in all their services and everything. So they tried. They tried doing the, you know, the plain Arc browser. Then they moved over to Dia, which is more, I think is going to be more about AI prompts, essentially, a browser.
And that was just within the last
fairly
few
recently.
Devendra, let me know if you think this roadmap for the future could be correct. So the browser company is notably a small company. Like, it does not have a huge AI research division. They said, yes, we're winding down our work on Arc. We want to move to a AI-powered browser, and that's going to be really cool, but we're going to need like a lot of time to work on it before we can even release any semblance of a beta product. Atlassian sees this and says, this is a great opportunity for us to make a company buy Dia if they also want Jira.
I mean, I could kind of see that. It's
an ecosystem thing.
It could totally be an ecosystem thing. I just see it sort of like the cynical side of me.
Because everybody's bought in on Jira.
I mean,
Jira's
already like essentially a standard, right? Like, yeah, everyone's there. But I could also see the browser company kind of looking at the end of its road, like the end of like its viability as a company, being like, we need an AI thing.
Well, yeah, because working on AI stuff is going to take a really long time.
I'm saying that browser, the initial browser Arc, there was no way it could ever like be successful. So the only way to survive is they got more funding. They raised $50 million at $550 million valuation last year. So this purchase is a little bit over that. But they raised that money with the pitch to, we're going to make an AI browser and we're going to do this really well. It doesn't matter. It actually does not matter if they built that AI browser or if it was successful or not. What they get is the buyout. They get to escape and be like, hey, we were successful. This big enterprise company bought us. How's Dia looking? Is Dia actually a good, does it compete with Google? Doesn't matter. We got paid already. You know, doesn't really matter if it's successful or not. So that's the cynical side of me. But again, this all does come back to Google's monopoly, you know, and just how hard it is for a small company to survive.
Yeah, I think this looks different from Salesforce buying Slack.
Also want to point out, like, Atlassian has been in the news lately. August 5th, not too long ago, they've laid off over 150 employees. That same CEO, Mike Cannon-Brookes, delivered the information via pre-recorded video message, and people basically found out they had to wait like 15 minutes to even get an alert if they were fired or not. And almost immediately after, they lost access to all their corporate stuff. And then shortly after, turned out he bought a $75 million Bombardier Global 7500 private jet. He has an estimated net worth of $13.9 billion. And his excuse was he wanted to be a present dad while managing a global company. So he needed the $75 million jet. But people are not did not take too kindly to this double thing. Oh, by the way, those laid off employees are going to be replaced by AI. Of course they are. Of course, like it's going to be like customer service people, people getting in the short term. It's all automation, you know.
We haven't even really talked about that MIT study that came out recently about enterprise AI not really working out in the short term.
We should bring that back up at some point. But yeah, essentially the gist of that study was like, yeah, enterprise AI has not actually made companies more more profitable or even more like functional, right? It has not been more productive, even though Microsoft and other people.
Yeah, and it was like some overwhelming percentage of companies.
And that was a Microsoft study, like, right? Yeah, I think that was a Microsoft itself study, but I have to go look back at that thing. Anyway, when we are skeptical about AI, this is why. Because it's being used kind of as an excuse to sell maybe a potentially failing product or an excuse to fire people, you know, without feeling too much blame. We will see what happens with the browser company when it's under Atlassian.
I think the browser company is based in New York City, so congratulations on your brownstones, everyone. So moving on. Instagram finally has an iPad app. We were literally just talking about this last week in the context of maybe Instagram will finally have an iPad app when the iPhone Fold comes out.
It took 15 years. I was there when Instagram launched in 2010. I reported on Instagram early back in the days. I remember like emailing those dudes when it was just like four people working on this photo app. Like, oh, this is cool. Who knows how far this will go? The idea that Instagram, which was quickly bought up by Facebook for $1 billion, don't forget, that it didn't have an iPad app was just so confounding for so long. Like it seemed like, okay, it's clearly purposeful. Facebook, for whatever reason, does not want to bring its best, one of its like most successful arms, like one of the most successful things it has to the iPad because maybe that would be too good for Apple. I don't know. I don't know what the thinking is there. I think Instagram always.
The only thing that I can come up with is that the iPad came out in
2012.
Instagram came out in 2012, yes. I think large adoption of the iPad has taken the better part of 10 years. Like, I only really started seeing iPads out in the wild. Maybe around like 2016, 2017.
You were right, by the way. It is 2010. I totally memory hold like when that thing actually launched. It did take a while because they were expensive and people didn't know how to use them. But also there were not that many great apps for a very long time. That was kind of the thing.
So if you want to be really charitable, you could say, oh, they were waiting for like larger adoption of the iPad.
No.
That is being way too charitable. I don't think that's correct at all, but there's something you can say.
I would love the behind the scenes like detail of, like why have you been so stubborn about this? Is it that you want to be so pure to the phone experience? Like Instagram can only be for phones because it's all about the scrolling and how you use your phone to take photos. We don't want people taking crappy photos with tablets. Is Instagram on Android tablets, which barely exist? Android tablets. Let me see. I mean, Android tablets just run an Android app, so it would be there. So they say a version for Android tablets is coming soon. But on Android tablets, like you could always just like make a normal app big. It would look awful, but you could just do that. That was harder to do on the iPad, and the form factor always looked bad. So anyway, do with this news what you will. Why did it take so long? Who knows? It's also coming at a point where I feel like everyone's like would rather be on TikTok instead of like Instagram Reels. What is funny about this app is that it seems like it's Reels focused. It is taking you to the Reels initially before your like overall Instagram feed. So that's interesting how they're rethinking Reels. Every time I go onto Instagram, the Reels are such a, I don't know, landmine. Of like, am I scrolling through content here or is something here weirdly like sexualized for no reason? It is weird how they have no filter on that.
There's also the fact that like Instagram Reels is still just TikToks that were posted like 3 months ago.
Yeah, yes. And then eventually those posts will make it straight into Facebook and then your parents and
your
older relatives will start sharing it. So it is a trickle down of culture in a really fun way. Anyway. Instagram, iPad app, tell us how you feel about it, podcastandgadget.com. One quick thing, we saw the release, Dolby announced Dolby Vision 2, expanding picture quality beyond HDR. Dolby says these tools will provide a better bridge between the creative professionals and the living room by using AI to automatically adapt your TV to what you're watching and while you're watching it. Content intelligence tools like Precision Black to help keep darker scenes visible and Light Sense that detects ambient light to create the best picture. There's also sports and gaming optimization. When I saw this news, people were initially freaking out. I was like, oh no, AI coming to Dolby Vision. I think this is more the algorithmic sensing of like what is on your screen, which is a form of AI, sure, but this is, things have been doing this forever. We've been doing like computer vision tools like this to optimize screens for a while. I think what they're doing is slightly making Dolby Vision better at making like bright scenes brighter without crushing everything. And dark scenes, visibly dark, but also not so dark where all the black kind of like runs into each other and you don't see much. So these are complaints people have had about that, watching things on like HBO and other, you know,
oh
other
my God, services. Yes.
Yeah. When dark scenes are too dark, if you have no dynamics between the levels of shade or levels like the gradients you've got, if your TV settings are off, things can go real bad. So the idea, I think, is Dolby Vision 2 could use a bit of like a bit of algorithmic juice to help prevent those issues. And also sports and gaming optimization could be interesting because that'll detail like white point adjustments, motion controls, which is normally the devil. Like normally you want to turn all motion controls off, but some people like it for sports. Some people like it for games because it makes everything look a little more clear at 60 FPS, or at least kind of looks like that or more lifelike. This is interesting. I have not seen this in action. We will likely see this at CES. They announced this at IFA this year, so I don't know if people actually got to see this stuff. Kind of makes me wish I was there.
User Kevin says in our chat, asks, is this connected to a move toward 8K or not?
No. I mean, eventually, sure, probably. But from what I'm seeing, I've been saying this for years, 8K is useless. 8K is garbage. 8K does not mean anything to you functionally as a consumer. It's only being used to sell TVs to schmucks, I guess. I don't know. People who see 8K, Samsung is doing a good job of that. But the 8K content isn't there. Every time I talk to TV makers selling 8K, they're like, oh, yeah, we've got really good upscaling. As if anybody will notice the upscaling from 4K to 8K. You don't just like make magic resolution, right? It may look a little bit sharper, but nobody can tell. Very few people can tell the difference between a native 1080p stream and 4K. So there's a lot here. I have no hope that 8K will be a major consumer thing until we have like 200-inch screens filling our entire walls. You know, maybe then you'll start to notice the difference between 4K and 8K. But until then, probably not. Instead, this is more about like where TVs are now. 65 inches plus. Again, we saw a lot of like 100 inch TVs on sale during Prime Day and during recent sales, like under $2,000. Those TVs, as they get so big, you're going to have some image quality issues. Things like what's the ambient light in your room? Can something adjust to that? Dolby Vision will have technology to like deal with that. They also say they have smarter motion smoothing in general. So maybe they could do something about that weird effect that happens. Like you don't want the over smoothed effect, but also a lot of people are annoyed by the judder that happens. If you think of like a movie when the camera pans left to right, if you're watching on a TV, that normally looks really stuttery. Like it doesn't look clear because your TV is processing that at 60 hertz usually in the US, but processing it there, it requires like weird interpolation to get to that point. You don't have that issue in a theater where it's being projected actually at 24 FPS. Maybe Dolby Vision 2 could save that, but we don't know. I've not seen this thing in action. Dolby says Hisense is going to bring the first TV to market. It'll include support on its premium TVs, including RGB mini LED models. I saw some RGB mini LED at CES, and they look incredible. It does look really good. TVs have come a long way. From like the last, honestly, just 5 years. Mini LED is real good. You don't need everything. Yeah. Final story, and this one's kind of cool. Uni has announced the new Volt V2 oven. It uses pizza intelligence to cook your pie more evenly. Again, AI everywhere. AI, all the things. Have you seen the Uni ovens in action, Ben? They look really cool.
I haven't, but when I heard about this pizza intelligence, it made me think a little bit about all the Zojirushi products that have neurofuzzy on them.
Fuzzy logic.
Well, yeah, and like that was a popular thing like a bunch of years ago. Remember when George W. Bush talked about fuzzy logic?
It is a thing because it's more about...
Well, yeah, but it's like misheard by most people who don't have at least a master's in mathematics, you know?
Yeah. It's because you can never accurately predict when a rice cooker will actually finish because it depends on the amount of water, the amount of rice, like what the level of steam is. And those fuzzy logic rice cookers did some algorithmic magic to figure out the best time to finish. Anyway, this Uni oven looks cool. It's an electric indoor oven that could cook pizzas up to 13 inches, the same as the Volt 12. It'll go up to 450 degrees Celsius. That's 850 degrees Fahrenheit, allowing you to cook a Neapolitan-style pizza in around 90 seconds. I've seen YouTubers and like cooking influencers use the gas version of these, and those have to be outside because it's super hot. But it is like having a full-on real restaurant-style pizza oven in your backyard, in your home. I can only imagine like the amount of electricity this would use to get to that heat. I have a Ninja, like a double layer Ninja, technically a toaster oven, but those things use a ton of power because it takes a lot of power to make this much heat. And this thing looks really cool. I would love the idea. My family and I, like, we have been doing more homemade pizzas, like just in the main oven. Making dough is hard, but at most grocery stores, you can usually find pre-made dough. Just get that out there. I kind of love this. I don't have the counter space for it. What do you think, Ben? Would this fit in your Brooklyn apartment? Doesn't look that big.
I do have a good amount of kitchen space, but I really don't think that I need a single-use appliance. And I think that is going to be the main barrier for most people. Doesn't matter how rich you are and how palatial your kitchen may be. People of all income brackets seem to dislike a single-use appliance in a lot of cases.
This is true. But if you have kids, you want to make dinner in 90 seconds. That the appeal of making homemade pizza is that, okay, slap the dough down, put some sauce, put some toppings, you've got dinner really quickly. In a normal oven, it takes like 10 minutes. But in this thing, 90 seconds. Oh, man. It's appealing. It's appealing. I don't know anybody who's actually bought one of these things, though. I'm all about the toaster ovens. The really cool toaster ovens also have like air fryer options. Most of my family's cooking is done in there. And then we have the Ninja one with two levels, so you could bake something up top and air fry at the bottom. It's fun.
We've gotten to talking way too much about toaster ovens and stuff. I'm going to end up cutting it earlier in the audio version.
No, leave it. We need toaster ovens. This is a good product recommendation because people often ask like, I don't use my oven, but how can I, you know, how do I make food for myself quicker? The problem for a lot of people is the tools we have are not great. Like a big oven takes a long time to heat up. It's not super convenient. A toaster oven. Toaster ovens are great. We'll do more talk on this at some point. Let's move on to stories from around and gadgets. Dan Cooper has written about the remarkable Paper Pro Move. He called it a pocketable version of its e-paper tablet. So, like, yeah, a smaller version of the writable tablet. This looks really cool. $449 at Remarkable. Yeah.
I'm so happy that I get to mention this. It's related to e-paper. Not so much Remarkable, but recently I was on vacation in Cape Cod. I went to this like big transit hub where you get like a bunch of buses to regional places because I wanted to go to Boston for a little bit before going home. And one of the bus stops had an e-ink display and it was beautiful. I loved it.
It's great. Sometimes they can be good.
And I bet it uses such little electricity that you could power it via like a solar panel on top of the pole.
E-ink, it's what's good. It's still
good. I just wish that Remarkable's stuff was a little cheaper and they had like a bigger offering of apps and stuff.
That's the problem. Like, it will forever be a niche product. And for people like Dan and myself, like, I love e-paper. I love e-readers because you don't get distracted with like phone apps and tablet apps. This looks cool, but it's $449.
Apple has the iPad. They own the market. And that's basically it.
Well, it's also, and that didn't even come about through like monopoly features, right? That came about because I was there. I covered this. Google's like, oh, tablets, big phone. It's just a big phone. They never really pushed developers to make tablet apps. So that is a much bigger, like that part of that market is just like people gave up. People just did not try. Microsoft was like, hey, Surface tablets, Windows in a tablet. Did you do anything to make Windows better optimized for tablets? Nah, let's not try that. That's too hard. So Apple ended up being the victor because of all of that. But anyway, Nate, who was just with us, reviewed the Acer Chromebook Plus Spin 514. Say that three times fast. Acer Chromebook Plus Spin 514. It's a new Chrome OS spinning like a convertible tablet or convertible laptop. Nate loves the Chromebooks, and I wish he was here for me to rag on the whole idea of Chromebooks, but this seems pretty cool. He calls it the new Chrome OS sweet spot. He just wishes it was a little cheaper. Got a score of 85 out of 100. I'm still... It's cool to have a convertible Chromebook. Like, I like convertible laptops because I like the tent mode where you put the keyboard on the bottom and you just flip the screen up, and it's great for sitting in bed with and for touchscreen stuff, but... Windows tablets are so much cheaper. You could do all the Chromebook stuff. You could do all the Chromebook stuff and still like run apps. So I will never fully be sold on these things. It's a $700 laptop as well. So maybe for people who just want web browsing in a light machine, maybe this could be useful. Also something, another fun thing. Sherlyn got a look at the Samsung Galaxy Tab S11 Ultra. Redesigned S Pen. Remember DeX? DeX is what happens when you plug in one of Samsung devices into a monitor and kind of function as like a mini desktop. She seems impressed. Like, even Sherlyn is like, has heard, like, we're not super excited about Android tablets. Even Google has given up on making new Android tablets. This thing is $1,200. I don't know who's going to buy a $1,200 Samsung Galaxy Tab S11 Ultra. I don't know who's going to buy this, especially when, again, there are not many great Android apps optimized for tablets. I don't know. I'd like to talk to the person who is intrigued by this and to see what they're into. I don't know. All right, let's move on to what we're working on. I'm spending a bit of time with GeForce Now, the new 5080 RTX 5080 server version. Can't talk about it yet. But I wrote up the news post about the announcement, and my initial thoughts on it are there. Tune in next week to hear what I think about that. And check out the post and Engadget. And let's move on to pop culture picks for the week. What do we got?
I don't remember how long ago I mentioned a book called The Employees by Olga Raven. I've been picking it up and putting it down for months because the format of the book makes it really easy to do. It's a sci-fi story told through more than 100 diary entries by the crew of this interstellar spaceship. I think it's implied that this is a leave Earth once and never come back due to the length of the mission sort of situation. Their ship is transporting these strange objects from an alien world that evoke hallucinations and strong emotions. Half the crew are human, half are androids in the style of Blade Runner or Alien, and all of them feel this strange pull toward the objects that pushes the story forward. These entries are really immersive because Raven is best known as a poet. Each chapter, if you could call it that, might be a few paragraphs long at most and full of this really picturesque language. The humans miss home, and they miss their kids, and they feel overworked, and somehow the androids are more existential than their human counterparts. Their entries seem confused about what people would even do if they weren't working all the time, and they feel sad that they missed out on being a kid and the fact that they'll never have children of their own. Longtime listeners know I love the game Control. Love the game Control. It doesn't match the tone of that game perfectly, but it scratches the itch for another really weird workplace whose story is told through documents. I liked it a lot. Go check it out.
That's fun. Real quick, just wanted to shout out, in the theater, I saw the new Spike Lee movie, Highest to Lowest. This is a Spike Lee remake of the Kurosawa movie, High and Low. It's very interesting. It's very Spike Lee, very maximalist. I think High and Low is one of the greatest thrillers ever made. Like, that is a movie. I just recently rewatched that and reviewed it on the Filmcast, my movie podcast. And just to see how everybody has taken from that movie, the sort of like morality play there, the sort of style of it, the use of shadows, just a beautiful film. High Stu Lowes kind of remakes that in modern day New York. Denzel Washington is a high level, you know, music executive. His son is kidnapped and things go from there. And I think it is still like trying to do some sort of exploration of the haves and have nots. It's just doing it in a very different, very Spike Lee way, but it's a lot of fun. And if you have Apple TV Plus, it'll be available to stream next Friday. It should be this Friday. Actually, yes, this Friday on Apple TV Plus. To just look up this exact date.
If you're listening to this later on, that's September 5th, 2025.
Yes, so. September 5th, 2025. You can stream it on Apple TV Plus. It was a great movie to see in a theater, and I kind of wish these things had a longer theater run. It basically has a couple weeks ahead of its release. The same thing is going to be happening to the next Knives Out movie for Netflix. But hey, my theater was mostly packed. People didn't want to just wait a couple weeks to see it in the comfort of their home because you want to see the new Spike Lee in the theater. And I think it's totally worth it. So check out Highest to Lowest when it hits Apple TV Plus, and it's still in some theaters. So if you care, you can still see it on the big screen.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. That's the end of the show. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Blue Sky and a podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
You can point me to other media that feels like control at Hey Bellman on Blue Sky. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.